Now, when this priest was there, my father had already died, remember? And I remember when he was very sick and dying in the hospital, you also ended up in the same hospital. So I was running between you and my father. And then my father died, and you came home, and then Robert was born. And all of these problems started. And when this Catholic priest finally solved the problem, but actually had caught me in a trap to make me believe a lie. And it worked, because both you and I were going to go back to the church, back to rituals, but have a normal life and no relationship with God, just a ritual.
Yeah, we were even able to go in our sports clothing to church. So we would go to church, you would do a few penances.
Penances, yes.
And then afterwards we would go in our sports clothes and go and do sport.
Exactly. There was no relationship with God, no knowledge of anything. And then we decided that it was so peaceful. And my father had died, and we had a little bit of money extra. And I was walking down our passage, and our passage had an archway and another archway through here, and there was a telephone there. And then you had to walk round to the dining room, and there was a little hatch where you served through to the kitchen. And when we had guests, you and I were constantly bumping into each other. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was small.
It was small, and it was all built
pokey.
Up. Pokey, yes. And you had to pass through a doorway and pass food through a hatch and go round and all of these things. And I think we bumped into each other the 50th or 100th time. And I looked at this setup and said, this is not working for me, and it's not working for us. And I looked at the structure, and I climbed into the roof to see what the situation was there in the roof, what was a bearing wall and what was not a bearing wall. And having satisfied myself, I went and fetched a sledgehammer.
Without explaining to me what you were planning to do.
Were you annoyed with me?
I wasn't sure what was happening. And the next minute, the hammer was flying in my kitchen. And I was screaming to you, what are you doing? What are you doing? No, it's all fine. It'll be fine. And you kept on hammering.
And I took the entire wall down, the entire arch, everything in the passage. I smashed everything to smithereens.
Yes.
And I never took any precautions, being me.
Yes.
And all the carpets and everything were full of dust. And you were very pleased with my result, right?
No. I was watching the whole kitchen being demolished, and then I turned around and I saw our three children stand in the door. They were covered in dust, and their eyes were large.
But there was a huge space and no more bumping into each other.
Yes, but that took a while before we could use it.
And you said to me, how am I going to cook now?
Yeah.
And there was a little primer stove in the garage, and I set it up for you in the garage, and I said, there, what's wrong with that?
One little stove. Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, we fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
But the kitchen was destroyed. It wasn't a very nice kitchen anyway. And so we set about finding someone who could build a nice modern kitchen for you.
Mm, open space.
With open space and open plan and all of these things. And eventually we ended up not only demolishing the kitchen, but demolishing just about everything else as well. And it turned out actually quite nice in the end, right? But then this carpenter arrived, and he was a German. And when he walked in, he said to me, I just want to know that I walk with Jesus. That was a red flag. That was a red flag for me, being an atheist. But I had this dichotomy because...
You were going to the church.
I was going to the church, and yet I was an atheist. How do you do that? And then I snapped at him, and I said to him, "You walk with Jesus, I just want a kitchen." And he got the message. But he's a stubborn fellow.
And he gave you?
A pamphlet.
A pamphlet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I looked at this thing and I didn't want to be rude because I already felt embarrassed because I'd been rude already. So I took it and I put it in the drawer. And he provided the kitchen. And for 1 year, approximately, that pamphlet remained in the drawer, untouched for a whole year. Just shows you, stuff in the drawer, you don't actually rummage through it again, right? So maybe you should just get rid of all the stuff that bothers you.
Well, it's good we didn't.
No, we didn't. And then I gave the lecture on evolution to the students. It was a medical class, approximately 400 students. And I was explaining the evolution of the kidney. And this young lady put up her hand and said, "Excuse me, Dr. Veit, I don't believe a word you're saying. I believe that God created. There is no such thing as evolution." And I ridiculed her to tears. I blasted her off the planet, much to the joy of the other students who laughed at her. I don't know. They laughed at her and ridiculed her as well. It's a very hard terrain sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Just for information, that young lady contacted us many years later, and she said she was that girl who sat in your class. And she sent us a picture.
And she sent us a picture, and she said she cannot believe that I had become a believer. Yeah, fascinating. But nevertheless, because I had done that, my conscience bothered me. And it bothered me to the point where I had to get rid of this feeling of guilt. And I remembered, well, you know, the Catholic Church can drive out demons. They can drive out guilt too. All you do is go and confess that you did something wrong, mm-hmm. and there's a magic wand that waves over you and the guilt is gone. And so I went to the church to find the priest to tell him that I'd been a miserable idiot. And he wasn't there. He'd gone shopping. And that was such an interesting experience, really. Because there he had gone shopping and I was sitting with a feeling of guilt that had to be gotten rid of. It's such a dichotomy of thinking. On the one hand, you're atheistic. On the other hand, you have to acknowledge that the church did something for you, so there is a God. But the only contact that you have with this God is through this church, and they tell you that you must confess your sin to a priest. Now, what if the priest is not there and you cannot confess your sin? And what if you come outside and a bus rides over you while you didn't confess your sin? Then obviously you're in trouble on the other side, if there is an other side, right? It's all so nonsensical. And I asked the nun, "Where is he?" And they said, "He's gone shopping. He'll be back in a while. Why don't you go and sit in the chapel and wait for him?" Which I did. But I was very agitated because everything has to do with time. I'm a busy man. I don't have time to wait to be forgiven. And if a bus drives over me and I'm not forgiven, then what's going to happen?
You have a German temperament.
Oh.
Yes.
How have you lived with my German temperament all these years?
I've learned to do it.
You've learned to do it?
Yes.
How did you manage?
How did I manage?
Yeah.
Well,
if I was still in that mode, I would have to find a priest for all the times that I made your life hard.
Well, yeah, it's not easy because impatience actually is hurtful to others.
Is it?
Yes, it is. Not taking time for other people it doesn't help anybody to be impatient with them.
So did your patience with me improve the situation, or is there still a lot of room for improvement?
Much better, much better.
Is it better?
Yes.
But is there room for improvement?
Oh yes, there's still room.
Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith.
Sitting in that chapel, so frustrated because I had so much to do. And this whole situation made no sense to me. Why couldn't I just, if there was a God, talk to him? Why couldn't I tell him, you know, I've been a bad boy and I really feel bad. I'm sorry, I'll try and make amends. Why couldn't I tell him? I had to wait for the priest, but the man was shopping.
Well, you didn't know God, so how would you know if God was there to listen to you?
Exactly. And as I sat there in that chapel and I looked at the altar, and there was this little chalice, this place with a little key on it and the little red light on top, and that tells you that the consecrated host is inside. And the consecrated host is the actual body of Christ. That makes no sense whatsoever. But you're supposed to believe it by faith that that host has been turned into the literal body of Christ. But it's his corpse, because he was sacrificed. It was a literal sacrifice, so he's dead. And I'm sitting there contemplating these things and saying to myself, I can't talk to him in any case. He's there in that box, but he's dead. And how does that make any sense whatsoever? Now I have to wait for a priest in order to tell him what my problem is. And as I looked at it from a scientific viewpoint, I started thinking that I had been duped again, because there was no logic in it. It didn't make any sense. Mm. And so as I got more and more frustrated because this priest didn't arrive, I got to the point where I thought, but does this religion make any sense? And why is there no contact. Why do I need this mediation? And who's the priest that he should be the mediator? And how does this work? And I decided that it wasn't logical. I was going to give it up. But in hindsight, I said something out loud, actually, to that consecrated host. And I don't know whether it was a good thing in hindsight or not. It probably was. No, it definitely was a good thing. But had I known what it entails, maybe I would have kept my mouth shut. But I said, if you exist, reveal yourself to me. But as for me, with this, I am finished.
Severe trial endured by the grace of God develops patience, vigilance, fortitude, and a deep and abiding trust in God. It is the triumph of the Christian faith that it enables its followers to suffer and to be strong, to submit and thus to conquer, to be killed all the day long and yet to live, to bear the cross, and thus to win the crown of glory.
And so I left without getting rid of my burden because the priest didn't pitch up. And I went back to my atheistic lifestyle. But I had challenged God. I said, if you exist, reveal yourself to me. And then I came home, and what did I do?
You were looking for something, and you were impatient.
No, I couldn't be impatient,
yes,
not
you
me.
You were impatient.
I'd learned patience by now.
No. And you asked me where this or that or the other is, and I said, how should I know? And then you started to open the drawers in the kitchen area.
Didn't you say to me on the left side of this one or that one? I can't remember exactly. Probably. You always know where everything is.
I can't remember. But you started opening the drawers.
And right on top lay a pamphlet that had been lying there for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it, and the pamphlet was in German. And it had 3 sets of commandments on it. And the one set was the 10 commandments as they occur in the Bible. And on the one side was the 10 commandments as they occur in the Catholic Catechism. And on the other side were the 10 commandments as they occur in the Lutheran Church. And then it says the Roman Catholic Church changed the commandments of God. And I looked at this and thought, this makes no sense whatsoever. What is this nonsense? And I called you and I said, look at this.
You know what the strange thing is? That I have seldom experienced since that time was when I looked at the pamphlet and I saw there was this thing about they changed it. It was like scales fell from my eyes. It was the Holy Spirit was impressing it on my mind. But I have never felt it that strong ever again. At that moment, I knew this is important. I didn't know.
But you didn't know why.
I didn't know why, but I knew this is important. There's something important about this.
And I looked at it and I said, this cannot be. And I said to you, have we got a Bible?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have a Bible. And then I remembered Tante Kippy.
Mm-hmm.
who had left me her entire inheritance when she died.
In a box.
And this poor lady who had been in a wheelchair almost her entire life, she was actually a bosom friend of my mother's.
Mm.
She was a young girl, and my mother and she were bosom friends. And then one day she was attacked in the streets of Cape Town, and a man hit her over the head with a plank. And she ended up lame, in a wheelchair, not being able to walk.
Or speak.
Not being, her hand was crippled, and she couldn't speak. And she used to say, Anna, can't speak. And she'd get so frustrated because she couldn't say what she wanted to say. And you had to guess what she was saying. And my father always fetched her at the home to give her a little bit of a homely environment and then take her back to the home. And when he died, we took that over, mm-hmm. remember?
Yeah.
And you would have to take her to the bathroom, put her back in a wheelchair, and we would have to guess what is she trying to say.
Yeah. But she was very, very religious, very faithful.
Very faithful, very religious. And such passions. I don't know how long she was in that chair. Probably 50 years.
It was very long.
Very long. And when she died, she left me everything she possessed, which fitted into one box. And it was old German magazines. It was a pair of knitting needles, I think. And
a Bible.
And I said, there must be a Bible in that box. And I put the box in the garage because what was I going to do with it? There was nothing in it of value. But because we had this link with her, I didn't have the heart to throw it away. So I put it in the garage. And did you remind me that there was a box and there might be a Bible in it?
I think you did.
Could
have been.
Yeah, go and look in that box. Maybe Tante Kippy has a Bible in there. And I went and fetched it. And lo and behold, here was a very worn out old German Bible, a smallish one. And to find the Ten Commandments was not an easy job because how do you find it? But we found it eventually. And lo and behold, there it was, exactly like the pamphlet said. And then, what does the catechism say? Now, fortunately, our oldest son had been going to catechism classes, and a volume of the catechism was on his shelf. So we fetched it, had a look, and lo and behold, it was exactly like the pamphlet said. Now, we didn't have the Lutheran one, but that was enough. Mm-hmm. What's going on there? And I phoned that carpenter a year afterwards. And I said, remember that you were in my house about a year ago and you gave me that pamphlet? And he said, yes, I remember. And I said, I read the pamphlet and I want to know what's going on there. Can you explain to me why the Ten Commandments were changed or what's the story there? And he said, can I come over to your house and explain it to you? And I said, sure.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it.
And he came that very evening to our house. And we sat virtually through the night going through the book of Daniel and Revelation.
Yeah.
In one shot, right through the night, we didn't go to bed. And Daniel 7 hit me like a ton of bricks. Here was a prophecy that was fulfilled to the letter. And it was written hundreds of years before the event. And I thought to myself, this can't be, this must be fake news. Do you remember that Bible study?
Yes, very well. I remember that he was speaking in German. My German wasn't very good at that stage. And he was reading from the German Bible to you. And I was following in. We actually went and bought some Bibles for you and for me. And I was following in the English, and it was almost the strangest feeling. I understood every word he was reading in German, and it was almost like I was reading in German and not in English. It was translated automatically into my mind, and I understood everything he was saying.
Yeah. And I said to myself, I can't believe this. So I went to the university the next day. And remember, I played squash with one of the mm-hmm. professors in the theology department. And I asked him about it, and he didn't have a clue what I was talking about. And I asked whether I can go and check things out in their library. And so I went through the library, and I looked at, I can't remember what I all looked at. But in the end, after that investigation, I couldn't refute the history. I couldn't refute the fact that all these empires had come one after the other. I couldn't refute the little horn. I couldn't refute what the Bible said. And that totally stunned me. Now, the Bible, of course, was a book of fairy tales, as far as I'm concerned. I'd never read it. And here I was confronted with prophecy. And it was harder for me than for you to accept it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You accepted it much easier than I did.
God said it, and I believed it. It was so easy.
Yes, but I couldn't.
But you couldn't.
No. I had to first find out, is it really true? Am I being duped? Am I being lied to? Is this another trick in my life? And then I said to him, on one of his next visits, I said to him, but if this is true here in the Bible, and this prophecy is irrefutable, I cannot deny it, then what about this nonsense about Genesis? I mean, I was an evolutionist, right? And I spoke to him about evolution, and he tried to convince me that God created the world in 6 days. Can you remember how I treated him?
You treated him badly.
What did I say? I can't remember.
Oh, that's nonsense. How can I ever believe that? And then he came back the next day with a pile of books, and he gave them to you, and you read through them within a week.
And gave them back to him and told him what?
I told him that's utter nonsense.
I've never read such a pile of tripe and rubbish in my entire life.
The poor man.
The poor man. But what did he do?
He came back with more books.
And I read through those books and I said to him, I don't believe this is a load of nonsense. We've had creationists here at our university and we love mocking them. Because they are absolutely ignorant in terms of evolution.
But you see, the problem is that all the churches actually believe in evolution. So it's fine for them to have God, but still believe that evolution took place.
But you see, if you believe in evolution, then you negate the entire plan of salvation.
But the thing is, now this man confronted you with something new. Suddenly, it's 6 days of creation, and in your mind, the Catholic Church doesn't believe in a six-day creation.
No, I actually asked that priest a year before when I went back to church. I asked him, how do you feel about evolution? He says, it's a fact.
Fine, yes. And the Dutch Reformed Church says, no, we believe in evolution. So for you, this was a new concept.
Yes.
How can you...
All right, so the plan of salvation and evolution are mutually exclusive. Because according to the Bible, death came into the world as a consequence of sin, so man was already there. And according to evolution, death leads to the survival of the fittest, and eventually you become what you are, up to the hominid stage. So then death is the means of evolving into a superior being, whereas the Bible says the very opposite. Mm-hmm. The superior being was there, and death is a consequence of sin. And where do you fit in a savior that is to conquer death that was the means to bring you about in the first place? It doesn't make any logical sense. So either evolution is true or the Bible is true, but they cannot both be true. So I said to the man, I don't believe in the creation account. I'm an evolutionist, I'm a scientist in this world, and I overwhelmed him with science and said to him, everything is millions of years old and these are all scientific facts, the same as a Richard Dawkins would argue today. And he lost his cool with me. And then he said to me, well, okay, then I don't have a problem with evolution. You have the problem with evolution, so you solve it.
It was a good challenge.
It was a good challenge, and off he went with his books. Mm-hmm. And I was angry because none of this made any sense to me, but you were quite happy.
Yeah, I didn't.
You didn't have that problem.
No, I didn't have that problem.
Okay. So I got back to the university and I said, what now? How am I going to solve this issue? And then I forgot about it, and then I had to lecture on genetics. Again, to the medical students. I had to give the course on genetics. And as I was studying my lecture so that I could present it to the students, I, for the first time, started thinking about genetics and evolution. Because natural selection doesn't work at the level of the gene, it only works at the level of the phenotype. Now, there are lots of lectures of that and people can look at. But I started thinking about how did it come into existence, and a little worm was eating its way into my mind. And then I was also teaching a course on phylogeny and evolution. And I was busy with the textbook, and I was reading the textbook. And I thought to myself, well, is there anything wrong with this textbook? So I went to the library and I actually said a prayer, which I thought was very stupid because I didn't know how to pray. I never prayed. But actually when I said, if you do exist, then show yourself to me, that was a prayer. Isn't talking to God a prayer?
Mm-hmm.
So I was mumbling to myself and mumbling to a God that I didn't believe in. And I said, if there's anything wrong with this, then show me. In my normal style. Took a book off the shelf, signed it out, went out. Colleague stops me, says, there's a new edition of that book. It's just arrived. It's in a box in the back. It's surprising. How did he know? But anyway, I went back into the library, went to the boxes, and sure enough, there was the new edition. So I took them both to my office, started reading them. And I was so stunned at how the new edition glossed over anything that the old one said quite bluntly. The old one would say, there are no intermediate fossils between this and this, so we don't know why they aren't. There should be, but they're not there. And the new one totally changed those sentences and glossed them over. So the old one was more honest than the new one. And I thought to myself, now, why would they not be honest? And that's how my quest started. But this is not an evolution talk.
But then what happened when you had to give a talk to the postgraduates?
Yes.
Yeah.
It got to the point where I asked myself a number of questions. We actually did a series on those questions. It's on YouTube, as I remember them. That bothered me as to what were the obstacles in the theory of evolution. And when I presented those 10 questions to those students, just the questions themselves, because some of them were virtually unanswerable and put evolution into the realm of faith more than into the realm of science, those colleagues were so angry. Remember how I came back and I was shocked that one of them was literally foaming at the mouth from anger.
Now, why were they angry?
Now, that's the important question, a very important question. Why were they angry? I mean, if it was just stupidity that I was sprouting, they could say, man, you're being stupid. Here's the answer. So why were they angry? Because they couldn't answer.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't answer. They were trapped. And when again, another girl, a postgraduate student, got up and said that those questions showed her that she need not have surrendered her faith. She said when she came to this university, she was a believer, and now she was an atheist, and now she sees that she's been duped.
Mm-hmm.
That she's been lied to.
And robbed of her faith.
Robbed of her faith. Mm. That's when they became angry. Because they couldn't answer. And it led to a whole new chapter in our lives. Because eventually, from that beginning, from that little kernel, a whole new chapter opened up. And the whole trustworthiness of the Bible,
mm-hmm,
that was in dispute now became a totally new experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you were doing Bible studies and you discovered things long before I did. People always said, oh, you're the one that believes because I believe, right? That was the other way around. You believed long before I believed.
Well, yes, I think that experience that God gave me when I knew this is important, from there on, I just drank in everything. Everything that I could read, just read it.
And then when it came to the Sabbath issue, I mean, they changed the law of God and they'd removed the Sabbath and changed it from Saturday to Sunday. You were studying your Bible, and what happened as you turned those pages?
Yeah, every page was Sabbath, Ten Commandments. Next page, Sabbath, Ten Commandments. Just
no matter where you looked
no
in the Bible.
No matter where I looked.
Isn't that
New or Old Testament?
Wasn't that supernatural?
It was supernatural.
Huh?
And I accepted it immediately.
You accepted it. And then somebody gave me that document written against the Sabbath, a colleague at university. In fact, it was the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't spoken to anyone at university about Sabbath or about my newfound interest in all of these things. But she came rushing down to me in the passage and said, I want you to read this. She was obviously a Christian. And she gave me an article as to why the Sabbath is wrong and why the Sunday is right. And I was still quite annoyed and thought, now, why would she give me this? And I was busy and I didn't have time, so I gave it to you. And I said, will you go through this?
Yeah, and I went through it, and on every argument that they had was not biblical. It had no quote from the Bible. It was Father so-and-so said this and Bishop so-and-so said that. And so I realized they are not. It's not based on the Bible, and I cannot accept it. And that was where I...
So the article I gave you against the Sabbath convinced you that the Sabbath is right because the Bible said the opposite.
Yes.
It took me a long while still to get to that point, because why would you keep a Sabbath to commemorate 6 days of creation if you didn't believe in 6 days of creation? So the whole question of evolution, creation was pivotal, because once I grasped it and once I had done enough research to realize that the Bible might just be plausible, up until that point, you couldn't really trust the Bible. If you cannot trust Genesis, then how do you want to trust Revelation?
Absolutely.
But Revelation has history written in advance, and Daniel has history written in advance. How can you explain that away? It's such a dichotomy in your mind. And I had to have those facts. I had to have it straight. But once you grasp that the Bible is true, then the adventure begins. So here I grew up in this country. I was an evolutionist. I didn't believe in God. And all I saw was what you see. But somehow, it still has an inherent message. It still has some beauty that no one can explain, that you can only experience. And that this is but a faint remnant of what it used to be like. Well, then something awakens in the soul which an atheist can never ever appreciate. I always used to believe, you're here, you're gone, you're history. But now there is something more. There is a hope of something greater, something even better, something even more beautiful than this. And can you imagine, with these sounds around you, what it must be like? It must be phenomenal. And if you look at all these creatures, and you marvel at the tremendous variety we find in nature, then it comes to mind that once upon a time, I believed that all of these creatures and everything that exists here were just a circumstance of chance. As a committed evolutionist for many, many years, teaching the theory of evolution at the university, it is hard for me to think like I used to think. How do you convince a committed evolutionist that everything we see and touch and feel around us is not a product of chance? Well, if you don't believe in evolution anymore, then life at the university becomes very hard. And so I resigned, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And the rector called me in.
Yes, and you still had to go and buy a suit to go and see the rector.
Because I didn't possess a suit.
No.
And he asked me so many questions. And one of the questions was, what is the truth? Who has the truth? Tough question, especially if you don't want to tell him what the things are that are going on in your mind, because number one, you're still a little bit dubious, you're still a little bit confused, and you're even a little bit ashamed of acknowledging the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, I basically told him, and we were without a job. And so we decided the only way to survive would perhaps be to sell what we had, buy a farm, and try some farming. I thought my university career was over. What university, what secular university would want someone who believes in creation? And how did you feel about all that?
That was big turmoil for us because the children were, they just started school and they were just settling into school life. And now suddenly we were thinking of taking them away for hundreds of kilometers away and into a farming community where the people are not exactly friendly to strangers.
Yes, it was a very hostile environment.
Yeah.
And we sold our house, put it in the market, and it was gone.
Within one day.
Within one day. The first person who walked in bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was still a famous person. He was a rugby player in the national team. And we had two partners in our venture, and off we went to the wilderness, in a wilderness experience. And we didn't have really a personal relationship with God yet. We didn't understand this God thing at all.
No.
And so we said to this partner of ours, when we have to ask something of God, you better ask him because you know him better than we do. and your contact is probably, your telephone line is probably better than ours. And that's how it was.
Mm.
And we had to learn to depend on no one but God.
Yes.
The devil can blow me over like a wind would blow a feather away. But when it comes to that righteousness which stands by the right hand of the Father, all the tempests of hell cannot prevail against it. That's the righteousness I want to stand in. Isn't that great?
God is a lover of the beautiful. He has given us unmistakable evidence of this in the work of His hands. He planted for our first parents a beautiful garden in Eden. Stately trees were caused to grow out of the ground of every description for usefulness and ornament. The beautiful flowers were formed of rare loveliness, of every tint and hue, perfuming the air. To Adam was given the work of caring for the garden. The Creator knew that Adam could not be happy without employment.
Tastes like a combination of melon and cucumber. So it's not very nice as a fruit as such, but it's much better tasting than a cucumber, so it goes well in a salad.
The beauty of the garden delighted him, but this was not enough. He must have labor to call into exercise the wonderful organs of the body.
Wow.
While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. It was the design of God that man should find happiness in the employment of tending the things he had created, and that his wants should be met with the fruits of the trees of the garden. Then they that have kept God's commandments shall breathe in immortal vigor beneath the tree of life, and through unending ages the inhabitants of sinless worlds shall behold in that garden of delight a sample of the perfect work of God's creation, untouched by the curse of sin. A sample of what the whole earth would have become had man but fulfilled the Creator's glorious plan.
Well, if you want to get out, then I guess you have to work. You just have to do it. If you don't have a lot of money, it doesn't have to be as big as this. This is just wilderness area. What I like about wilderness area is there's nothing. And you have all this space around you. You can shout, you can take a stone, you can throw it as far as you can, and you won't be able to throw it off the land. It's hard work. And I had three or four of the local not qualified builders to help me with the brickwork. A lot of the inside work I would do when I came back. And my wife had this terrible accident and was out of commission entirely. She couldn't help at all with any of the building except laying out the garden, saying how, but she was on crutches. She couldn't do anything herself.
Because the cellulose also has this structure, and the polarity of the water goes like this, and the next molecule is pulled up, and the next one is pulled up, and so the water goes all the way up this artesian stream. But any impurity, like a heavy metal or being bigger molecules than the water molecule and not having a polar structure, will not move up with it.
Doing good is an excellent remedy for disease. Those who engage in the work are invited to call upon God, and He has pledged Himself to answer them. Their soul shall be satisfied in drought, and they shall be like a watered garden, whose waters fail not.
And so God arranged it that within a very short period of time, just a few months, through many trials and circumstances, which you write about in the book, which we don't have to repeat, suddenly we were left alone without partners, with all the responsibility and no income.
Mm-hmm.
The economy took a dive because of sanctions. South Africa was the pariah of the world.
Yeah.
Inflation skyrocketed. Interest rates at the bank rose from a few percent to 35 and 36%.
Yeah.
Per year, nobody could afford to have a loan at the bank.
Mm.
And so basically, we went bankrupt. No job, no income, no support, nothing.
And we tried to sell the farm and nobody was willing to pay at those interest rates.
No, nobody was willing to buy, so the value dropped dramatically.
No. Mm.
And so we couldn't sell it and we couldn't keep it.
Mm.
And no job. And there was nobody to pray to God for us. Because they were gone.
Yeah.
And so we had to pray to God ourselves. Actually, we were quite silly, right?
Well, we learned from our background We didn't know exactly, because we were baptized, and then straight after we were baptized, we went onto that farm. So we didn't really have an experience of how you worship and how you trust God.
So, no idea whatsoever. No. So didn't know anything about spirit of prophecy.
Nothing.
Why had nobody told us anything?
Nobody told us anything.
I knew what Daniel said. Mm. I knew what the book of Revelation said. I knew that Jesus was the Messiah.
Yeah.
And
but no experience with God.
No, no experience with God, but never this, having walked with God.
This farm was there to teach us that experience with God so that we could learn that we have to trust only Him. We cannot trust everybody or anything.
And when everything went topsy-turvy, rather a sad story how it all turned out, we used to get phone calls from people telling us that we were on the wrong path.
Mm.
And I remember that colleague, ex-colleague of mine, phoning me and saying the most horrendous things against the spirit of prophecy. And he mentioned the name Ellen G. White. And I'd never heard about that. And remember there was a coal porter, one who deals in books, who used to come past our farm occasionally, and he would leave us books. Remember him?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was a sweet man, eh?
Yeah, he reminds me of François Duplessis. Same stature, same kind of person.
And he used to leave books, and when this person reviled these writings, I remembered maybe there are some of those writings there, and that prompted me to start reading, and it prompted you to start reading. And you grabbed a book, and what book was that?
The first one I got was Counsels on Diets and Foods.
And the first one I got was Desire of Ages.
Yes.
And I read through The Desire of Ages, and you read through Counsels on Diets of Food, and my life turned into a misery overnight.
Well, I remember I tried to cook without eggs, without milk. The meat was not even the worst part of it, but without the eggs and the milk and the cheese, I struggled. And then at one stage you said, look, I can't eat this anymore. From now on, we're just having bread and we're having fruit and nuts. And until you have mastered the skill of cooking properly without those things. And that's what we did for a whole year. We had fruit and grains and bread but some vegetables, but mainly we did fruit and nuts.
And we felt better than we'd ever felt before.
We were very healthy then.
Yes.
And then after I'd gone through some practicing, we started to cook again.
Yes.
Because
you have to retrain your palate.
Yes.
But in any case, we were totally devastated, totally bankrupt, and now we had to talk to God. I'd read Desire of Ages. I knew who Jesus was now. Mm-hmm. And I compared it always with the Bible. Basically, we were on a quest by ourselves.
Yes.
There was no mentor except those books. By the way, those are the best mentoring tools that you can possibly have. And then we sat down one day because we had no more funds, no more food.
Nothing.
Nothing in the bank, huge debt that we couldn't pay. And you and I, we knelt down.
We were very depressed.
Very depressed. And we prayed. And what did we do?
We said, we are going to write a letter to God. Maybe He'll understand better if we write to Him.
So we wrote it all down.
We wrote a letter. And we said, Dear God. And we explained to Him what our problem was. And
basically said to Him, we have come to the end of the road. There is no solution as far as we can see. I am fully educated in what I used to do. I can't go back to the university. they won't have me. And so how are we going to survive? What are we going to do? And we wrote that letter and signed it. You signed it, mm-hmm. and I signed it.
Yeah. And we put it in an envelope, and we left it on the table. And then we went to bed.
Yes.
And the next morning...
we get a phone call.
You got a phone call.
And it was a professor from a university. And he said to me, "Are you still available to teach?" And I couldn't believe my ears. And I said, "Yes, why?" And he said, "Because we have someone who has gone on leave for a year, a sabbatical year, and we need to replace that person. So would you be willing to do that?" And I said, "Yes, but you've probably heard about my changed views about evolution." And he said, "I only want you to teach physiology. I don't care what you believe. Would you help us for a year?" And I said, "Yes." And then he said something that dampened my spirit again. He said, "We have to get it through the various committees, and the rector has it to approve it. And I'll contact you again when that is done. It'll take a few weeks." And we said, "Thank you very much, God, but in a few weeks we're probably dead. We need an income." And we left it at that. And then about 2 hours later, he phoned again. And he said the strangest thing happened. He met the rector of the university in the passage and said he wanted to discuss this issue and could it be tabled for discussion. And the rector said to him, "I'm on my way overseas. I have no time for these things. What is it that you want?" He explained it to him. He said, "Where's the paper?" He signed it. And that was it. I was appointed. And I said, "When?" That was a Friday. He said, "Monday." That's a weekend. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in a bigger flat because what were we going to do now? We had a farm.
Cows.
We had cows. They had to be milked. Who was going to do that? And as we were still wondering as to how this should be done, what happened?
Well, it was probably maybe a day or two later or a day later. A young couple from Zimbabwe knocked at the door and they were suddenly standing there and they said, "We know that we haven't announced that we're coming, but we really, really need a place to stay. We've been working on a farm there and we weren't able to keep the Sabbath anymore. And the man threw us out, the owner of the farm. And can we come and farm for you? Can we come and help you?"
And we said?
We said, "Thank you, Lord, for answering the prayer."
So they took over, and I had instantly a job, which created more of a problem.
We had to move.
Because now we had to move, we had to find a place. Well, all of that fell into place. I think you probably say something about that.
Mm.
So back I was in the university in a temporary relief position. And that was only for a year. And as that year came to an end, I was wondering, what are we going to do now? And then before that time of replacement was over, they called me from another university. And the same thing happened. I replaced someone. And when that time came to an end, that was a very interesting time because I gave many lectures on creation, evolution, and topics at that university and caused total turmoil. And then that came to an end, and I was wondering what we were going to do next. I came to the conclusion that there must be a designer. We had a discussion class, an evolutionary discussion class at our university. And I made a list at that stage of about 10 questions which seemed to pose a major challenge to the general evolutionary way of thinking. And I put these 10 questions, one after the other, on the board, and the result was phenomenal. There was such anger in my colleagues, such fury, which eventually blossomed into open antagonism and hatred, that it struck me that the theory of evolution is not just an issue of scientific debate, this is a religion. Then the man that you called Uncle Frenchy in your book came back into a permanent relationship in terms of evangelization. And for a whole year, we worked for the conference together with him, and we did campaigns all over the Cape Province. So we did campaigns in Cape Town, we did campaigns in Paarl, we did campaigns all over. We even held campaigns in the Opera House of Cape Town and filled it a number of times. It was really a marvelous period.
And he taught you, he was your mentor, and I think if he hadn't drawn you into evangelism, you probably would never have done it on your own.
Correct.
So the Lord used him to draw you into that world.
Evangelism. Yes. And so evangelism became second nature. And then he was taken away. He was taken to another district, far away. And again we were alone. Mm. And I started my own campaigns with my own lectures. But then that year, that was only for 1 year, came to an end, and now there was a problem. Where was I going to find work? What was I going to do? And as that came to an end, I got another phone call, again, from the first university. Wouldn't I please apply for a job that they were advertising? And the professor phoned me and said to me, "It's yours. Just send in an application." So I sent in the application. And then he phoned me back after a while and said, "Unfortunately, because of the new laws in the country, the job wasn't available to me anymore." And again, I put the phone down and thought, now what is going to happen? And just as in the previous one, a very short while later, he phoned back and said, "It's yours." Because the person that they earmarked for it wouldn't work for the salary.
And we were willing to work for anything.
We were willing to work for anything, yes, just to put food on the table. And to make a long story short, very short period of time, really. And sadly, while I was there doing the work that I normally do, the professor got sick and died. And the post was advertised, and I was promoted to professor and head of the department. So in an amazing way, God opened the doors, and I was back in university, but not under pretense. They knew exactly what we believed. And God miraculously kept us in that position for 15 years, taking care of all our needs. It's amazing, huh?
Mm-hmm.
God is good. The miracles that happened, yeah. And how we eventually got out of debt, and all of those stories.
In the way that leads to the city of God, there are no difficulties which those who trust in Him may not overcome. There are no dangers which they may not escape. There is not a sorrow, not a grievance, not a human weakness for which He has not provided a remedy.